morning I would like to give a little bit of a pictorial representation of Nebuchadnezzar's image. I'm going to do it by the use of maps, but I also have a little background information before we start doing this, and I'll kind of work it in as we go. You know, our Lord's words recorded in Luke 21, verses 34 to 36, I'm not going to read it, but I think we're all familiar with it. It has particular reference or importance to those believers living just prior to our Lord's return. His words are an urgent warning to be ready or prepared to serve oneself at the expense of serving Yahweh and His Son will result from being negligent, self-indulgent, self-reliant, or having self-interest. Christ's warning is aimed at every individual disciple. He says, take heed to yourselves, remain or be always on guard. Do not ignore the urgency of the times in which we live. Do not feel secure and satisfied with our current lives. Do not be associated with the ungodly ways of the world. And we know that the cares of this life is a phrase which denotes a divided or a distracted mind. And this results in concern and anxiety unto us. A divided loyalty is our greatest failing at times, for a double-minded man is unable to set in order his priorities, as James chapter 1, verse 8 notes. You know, the words in Luke 21, you know, the sea and the waves roaring. And I think this is what we see today. And it's sort of like a tsunami now. It used to be sort of a gentle, but now it's like a tsunami. I mean, it's unbelievable how things are developing in the world at large that show us that the Lord's return must be nigh. And the thing I like to bring attention to here is the fact as that these things are coming to pass and they're visible to us, but we know this, that the Lord's saints will be called out in advance of these things, many of these things. So therefore, that's why I think we need to be very careful of where we are right now. And I'm going to bring out a few current events as well as we go along a little bit later. But the main thing I see with us is the fact we're not like those that when Brother Tommy talked about, Peter talked about those before the AD 70 coming of the Roman armies against Jerusalem. And, you know, their words were, where is the promise of His coming? Well, I don't think I see that with this ecclesia. I think this ecclesia is really spiritually minded to a large extent. And I think our problems are this, is that as we live in this world, the world we live in is a very difficult world to live in. Financially, it's a moral, it's morally abject, so to speak. It's down in the bottom somewhere. We have associations with things that we wish we didn't have associations with. Our schools are not what they used to be. Our families have a hard time making a living in this world because inflation is so great. We have many things that detract from a spiritual mind. And if our mind is distracted so much that it's hard to keep our mind in a spiritual realm, so to speak. And so that's what I mean by divided loyalty, is that we're so concerned with living over here in this world and getting by and having enough food on the table and whatever, that sometimes we lose sight of the fact that, you know, that things are happening which portend our Lord's return. So I want us to keep these things in mind as we go about these things. Now, we know that in about the period of 604, probably 606 to 539 B.C., it is a period in which Daniel revealed unto Nebuchadnezzar, the Babylonian king, that the great image's head was of fine gold, as we note up here on our up on the image up here on the wall. And he told Nebuchadnezzar in verse 38 of chapter 2 that thou, Nebuchadnezzar, art this head of gold. Now, by turning to Daniel 7, verse 4, if you would, you might turn over to Daniel a minute. Daniel 7:4. Turn these pages today. Okay, it states that the first was like a lion and had eagle's wings. I beheld till the wings thereof were plucked, and it was lifted up from the earth and made stand upon the feet as a man, and a man's heart was given to it. We find this is further elaboration upon the what I would call this head is the Assyro-Babylonian head. It's not just Babylon, but it's the Assyro-Babylonian head. And we will see this as we go along to show that this Babylonian head had both a military aspect to it, and it has not only that, it has an ecclesiastical aspect. And this is what we will see in the latter days. We will see this same image standing with that type of head. Now, we read that the first was like a lion, and it had eagle's wings. And this is a depiction of the kingdom of men and its government centered at Nineveh. And I can show you this on this map here. And I didn't even bring my black pen. Does anybody have an overhead pen? But anyway, I won't be able to exit out here. I knew I forgot something. But on this map here is at Nineveh, and it's kind of hard for me to see on this map. But let's see. I want to look at Babylon, rather. Babylon's right about here, and Nineveh is right up here.
Thank you very much.
Appreciate it. I'm going to do this again, man. So Babylon is right here. I don't know if it's going to write. You sure it has ink in these things? There. And Nineveh's there. So you see, this is the kingdom can y'all see that very well? It's kind of a little bit hard to see, but this is the kingdom that Nimrod founded. And when I want to point out this is not the best map that I have. It's just the only one I have. I couldn't find my other ones. I'm always losing maps. But anyway, you notice this Assyrian Empire, eventually this Assyrian Empire went all the way down here, and even a little bit into Egypt. Eventually it did. And then the Babylonians came in and overtook the Medes and the Babylonians, overthrew Nineveh in 612 B.C., and then they enlarged the empire a little bit. And this is the empire we see then of Assyria and Babylon. Now, the archaeologist Layard, he proved this conclusively, about this Assyrian empire, by uncovering sculptured lions, in his digging that had wings, which spread over the back. He discovered these in his diggings there, and that was just a great proof of Daniel 7:4. And one thing about the Assyrian in its early days was that historians tell us that during all of their history, the Assyrian people were of one family or bloodline with the people of Babylon, and they were, because Nimrod found them. And their land was likewise of almost one piece. The land of Assyria is scarcely detachable from the Assyro-Babylonian land. And I took this from Unger's Bible Dictionary. Well, the scriptures support this. For in Genesis 10, verses 10 to 12, we find that Babylon and Nineveh, or Assyria, were builded by Nimrod. And I think this is very important because it sets the foundation for the establishment of the kingdom of men, both past and present. Because we know that the Catholic system has incorporated the Babylonian doctrines within its own church system, as well as the other three kingdoms. Well, the Assyrian Empire, we know, established a reputation for military dominance and cruelty, which was almost without parallel in history. And we will see this again in the latter-day Assyrian. Because when we're looking at Babylon and Assyria, we're looking at the types of the latter-day Babylon and Assyria, one with ecclesiastical head, being the Roman system, and one with a military aspect, and that being the Russian, in control of the eastern leg of this image, as well as the western, but he will be situated basically in Constantinople. And according to one historian, one of the chief contributions of Assyria was the military protection given to Babylonian civilization when it might have been engulfed by barbarians. Now, this is an extremely important point because it exactly describes the role of the latter-day Assyrian in regard to its military and its political control of the kingdom of men. Now, in Daniel 7:4, we find that these wings were plucked from the lion, and here we have a change in the rulership of this kingdom. No longer was it to be centered at Nineveh, but at Babylon. And when we're looking at latter day, first of all, the Russian god will be destroyed, and then the Roman will be left by itself in Rome in control of this kingdom. This is exactly what happened in history. Is exactly what we'll see again. I told you that Nineveh was destroyed or taken over in 612 B.C. by the Babylonians and the Medes. And this was a reemergence then of the Assyrian Empire centered at Babylon. It was still the same Assyrian Empire. It was a Syro-Babylonian Empire. But historians many times will talk of the Babylonian Empire as it being Assyrian, and that's the reason. But it had all of the Babylon had all of the weaknesses or vices well developed in its priest system. Alexander Hyslop, in his Two Babylons, wrote that from here was the primal source from which all systems of idolatry flowed. And Hyslop clearly shows that the Babylonian character of the papal church, whose ecclesiastical power will first be under the latter-day Assyrian, he clearly shows this. Now, we're going to have another change here. Another change that we want to look at is in the breast and arms of silver. Now, the Babylonian kingdom ruled until about 539 B.C., when another political change was made in the kingdom of men. And Daniel 2:32 records that the images, breast and arms were of silver, as we note on our image up there. And that the power represented by this somewhat inferior metal, we know silver is a little less of value than gold, and today it's quite a bit less, but silver would, this silver kingdom then would arise immediately after Nebuchadnezzar itself, after his kingdom fell, and it would be an inferior kingdom. Further detail is given in Daniel 7:5. It is recorded that another beast, a second, like to a bear, and it raised itself on one side. All this is depicting is the fact that it denotes the Persian superiority over the Medians. The Medes were a helpmeet, so to speak, for the Persians, and they kind of intermarried and so on. Now, Cyrus was this ruler over the Persian Empire, and he was a very interesting ruler because his name means like the air. We can read in Isaiah and so on, Isaiah 45, that this king was one who was somewhat favorable in a sense because he was a type of Christ in a sense, and that he allowed the Jews to go back and rebuild their temple. Now, in Daniel 8:3, even further detail is given, where a ram with two horns is introduced, which also describes Persian supremacy over the Medes. And the bear in Daniel 7:5 had three ribs in its mouth, which speaks of three main kingdoms which Medo-Persia devoured. They devoured Lydia in 546 B.C., Babylon in 539, and Egypt in 525 B.C., And Brother Thomas wrote this in the exposition of Daniel, that the bear was the symbol of this government whose dominion extended from India to Ethiopia, even over 127 provinces. And I hope this map will show here. It may be a little dim, I don't know. But yeah, that's pretty hard to... I don't know if we can get that any better or not. It's kind of hard to do that from here, but anyway. Can y'all see that at all? Maybe you see it better than I can. I tell you, these old maps I have kind of faded over the years. But anyway, I want you to note here, this is all the way over to the edge of India, this boundary right here, which is right where Persia, what am I trying to think about? Pakistan is today. And you notice that it goes all the way over and goes over in partially into Greece there, and around, and it covers Asia Minor, comes all the way down through North Africa, down into Egypt, and back over through Israel, and down all the way down back into Babylon. Now that is a huge empire. It had 127 provinces, and Brother Thomas quoted this about this Medo-Persian Empire, that it's to be represented by the image in the latter days. Persia must be a constituent of the dominion represented by it. So in Ezekiel 38, when it speaks of Persia being a follower of God, I think it's talking about this whole territory. It's not just talking about, people say Iran. Well, Iran was the center of Persia. But this whole Persian Empire is what's being talked about. And I tell you what, that map is really bad. I can't even see it. But anyway, if anybody wants to see it afterward, you can see it better up here. Against something white, it shows up a little bit better. But anyway, this is a great empire. And I had one other thing I wanted to read about it. And this is from the Exposition of Daniel. And it's on page 12. This is a very important reading, because it speaks of something that we will see in the latter days. It says this: In dismissing this symbol, it is worthy of remark that while the ram by which the Persians represented themselves in Daniel's time is their symbol in relation to the Macedonians under Alexander, because if we know that Alexander the Great overthrew this Medo-Persian Empire, the deity has chosen for them the bear to signify them as an element of the image in the latter days. So this Persian Empire will be represented by a bear in the latter days. The latter day symbol then of Persia is a bear, and a bear is at this time her formidable neighbor. And Russia is also known as the bear, the Russian bear. The Russian bear will overtake the Persian bear, that's what he's saying here. And has already taken from her a large portion of her territory. Russia has took a lot of this Persian territory and brought it into its own territory. The Russian bear is destined to supersede her present government as an independent sovereignty, and to grasp Persia between its teeth from near India to Ethiopia, which is to be at his steps. This is no mere conjecture, but absolutely certain. For Yahweh has declared by Ezekiel that Persia shall be an element of Gog's confederacy, and that Gog is the Russian power, will be seen when I come to treat of the king of the north at the time of the end.
Okay.
Another empire then begins to take its place, which we really need to look at. Get my stuff out of line here. These things. It's the belly and thighs of brass, and this empire, of course, is the Grecian Empire. The Grecian Empire overtook the Medo-Persian Empire, and once again, the belly and thighs of brass of Nebuchadnezzar's image. And this took place in about 333 B.C. and ran to about 30 B.C. when the last part of that empire, Grecian Empire, was taken by the Romans in 30 B.C. Well, Daniel 2:32 speaks of this third empire as represented by belly and thighs of brass, and Daniel 2:39 records that it would bear rule over all the earth. And we know in Daniel 7:6, another symbol is given. A leopard represents the Grecian Empire before its division. Four wings of a fowl on its back, and also had four heads, a fourfold division of the Grecian Empire. Now, we know that the Grecian Empire was broken up into four different parts. And one of the main parts of this empire was the Seleucid. I don't know if you can probably see that either. It isn't any different. But if you can kind of see, I may have to draw this on here a little bit. This empire is all the way over here in Greece. I'm not going to be exact on this drawing here. Not much better, but this way. That red line represents the great extent of that empire, tremendous extent. And this is what we're going to see in the latter days. We're going to see a power control all of that area as well. You see, each one has a little bit different part of the whole area. And it keeps getting larger and larger. And eventually, the Romans are going to add the last part of it, which will go all the way through the Atlantic. Therefore, we'll have one from the Atlantic all the way through Russia and all the way over to India, having the Holy Land and Northern Africa as well. And we know the Romans were very big in Northern Africa. Well, further elaboration of this Grecian Empire is given in Daniel chapter 8, 5, which is a goat which represents Greece. And it had a notable horn, which was Alexander the Great. And Alexander the Great, interestingly enough, he died in Babylon at the age of 33 forming that whole huge empire at 33 years of age. He died in Babylon. And he was, in effect, part of that Babylonian empire. I mean, really. You see what we're saying? The Grecian Empire, the Medo-Persian, they're all, part of this Babylonian empire. Now, that was Daniel 11, verse 4, and Daniel 8, verse 8. They record Alexander's death in a division between those four generals. Now, two of the generals, the Grecian Empire was down here. The Seleucid Empire was up here. And these two generals battled each other, over a number of years. Back and forth, battle, to see who controlled this. This Seleucid part of the empire actually went a little further than that. I don't think you can probably see it anyway. But anyway, this whole empire battled back and forth for control over the Holy Land. And this is part of the things that we see that are developing in today's world, is the fact that we're going to see an empire that will take this whole power over. Now, this Seleucid Empire of Alexander the Great was taken over by another power, and it's represented by the iron legs of the image. Now, the legs of iron, if we're looking at about 430 B.C. when the Romans came on the scene, and they first got their presence into the Holy Land in about 126 B.C. when Attalus III, who was the Pergamum king. Now, Pergamus, we're all familiar with the Ecclesia of Pergamus. Well, in 126 B.C., Attalus III, he willed his kingdom to Rome, and Rome was glad to get their foot in the door over there. And they were over there as early as 126 B.C. We know that that's much earlier than that. It's hard to believe that they were there that early, but they were getting close to the Holy Land by getting there in 126. But by 65 to about 62 B.C., this power annexed this Seleucid Empire, this northern part up here. And by 30 B.C., they took the Ptolemaic or the Egyptian part of the empire. These two Grecian empires came under Roman control from 65 B.C. to 30 B.C. Now, this was the official end of this Grecian brass empire, and it signaled the change in Nebuchadnezzar's image from brass to iron. And we know in Daniel chapter 4, verse 15, verse 23, verse 25, it talks about Nebuchadnezzar's great tree being hewn down with its stump left in the ground, with the roots under it, banded with bands of brass and iron. This is very important. This, because this is how it happened. Now, interestingly enough, around 395 A.D., the Roman Empire became divided when the king of Theodosius died. And it was divided among two of his sons, and they split the empire. We had a western part of it in Rome, and we had an eastern part in Constantinople. And we know that Constantine, even in the year 324, established this city, first of all. Now, and even though the what happened in from that point in time, from 395 to 476, the barbarian nations began to invade this Roman Empire. And by 476, those 10 barbarian tribes took over the Roman Empire. But funny thing happened on the way to taking them over. These barbarian nations were all brought in to the Roman system. So they were changed from their pagan beliefs to their so-called Christian beliefs. The trouble is, they brought in all of this pagan belief and they infused it into this Roman system, to which today we see the Roman system has barbarian influences all through. There was ten of these. I won't read them all, but there was 10 of them. And you know, by 604 A.D., the papacy reached new heights, assimilating then even the barbarian conquerors. And the eastern leg of the image, or Constantinople, a funny thing happened on the way to it. From 604 A.D., it was about another 800 years, like 1453, this eastern leg was brought in, was taken in by the Turk, the Ottoman Turk. And so therefore, here we had the image. See, the image has never stood, and it can't stand, because it does not have a power that will unite all of these different influences and nations and powers. We must have something at the end that will unite with that clay. We need a clay power in the feet, the iron feet, to unite that image and allow it to stand. It has never stood. And therefore, that's the power that the power we're speaking of here is the Russian power. Now, I want to show this Roman. I think we'll see this Roman a little better. Those other maps aggravate me. I have to find my good ones. But this is the Roman Empire. I think we can see that one pretty well. Now, look how far it goes over to the west. It goes over to the Atlantic Ocean. It goes over to Spain. It takes in a great part of northern Africa. It goes all the way through Egypt, up through the Holy Land, all the way up past Asia Minor, up around the Black Sea, all the way up over into Europe. And interestingly enough, it did not quite take all of Germany, but we know that Germany was brought in by other aspects of this kingdom. Now, I want to mention another important thing in regard to this barbarian nations. How did the barbarian nations get kind of beaten back, so to speak, when they took over in 476? Well, about the year 533 A.D., the imperial government was restored to Western Rome by the Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian. And the Eastern Roman Emperor Justinian had his power right here. That is Byzantium, or Constantinople. And this is, from this area then, we would see Nebuchadnezzar's image. We would see his left leg, so to speak, standing right there when Russia takes over. Because Russia's influence, if you notice this Black Sea here area, there's a very narrow straits through here to get out into the Mediterranean. And Russia has long looked at that in order to get through that area. She's long looked at that as a means whereby she can control the Holy Land, the Suez Canal, the oil shipment areas, the Saudi Arabia, the sources of oil, the Dead Sea, which is one of the most important mineral producing areas in the whole world. It's 1,300 feet below sea level. It has billions of tons of needed minerals that the world needs. A lot of it fertilizers as well as minerals to make weapons and such. I think Russia has her eye on that as well. Not only the oil areas, and if you're cutting off of Western oil, if you cut off the Suez Canal, you pretty well cut off a lot of oil shipments, you know, because most of them that go through there from Saudi Arabia make it to the Western nations a lot easier. Now, what was it that Justinian did that made it so important, made him so important? Well, we know that in 324 A.D., Constantine moved the capital of the Roman Empire. He moved it from over here at Rome. And you see, those are the two leg areas of Nebuchadnezzar's image. He moved it over there. And Rome, he called it Nova Roma. When he moved it from Rome to Constantinople, he called it Nova Roma, which meant New Rome. But we know that Constantine, it soon became known as Constantinople, named after Constantine. And interestingly enough, it was built on seven hills, and Rome itself is built on seven hills. On May the 11th, 330 A.D., the city was dedicated to the Holy Trinity and the Mother of God. To keep alive the Hellenistic culture, libraries were built and filled with Greek manuscripts. So therefore, it has a Greco-Roman influence even in the East. The image empire banded with iron and brass. Brother Thomas wrote that Justinian was the fittest representative of the civil element of the power that has yet appeared in Constantinople in its dealings with the god or pope delighted to honor him. What we're saying here then is that Justinian will be a type of Justinian, will control Constantinople, will give the pope in the West his authority as ecclesiastical head, and will be the ruler over all things. And I'm going to prove this by showing what Justinian did. The celebrated letter of Justinian to Pope John II was dated March 533 A.D. There was both a solemn recognition of the pope as head of all the churches and a formal subjugation even of the eastern churches to his rule. Justinian's pragmatic sanction, this is very important, a very important document, it was issued on August the 13th, 554 A.D., regulated ecclesiastical, economic, and political affairs in Italy. It was not the pope's role to become a leader equal to the eastern emperor. Interestingly, this is what Brother Thomas saw as a type of the latter day. We will have a ruler from Constantinople that will do the same thing. And history repeats itself so many times, over and over and over and over and over. And we will see it again. Interestingly enough, by 800 A.D., Charlemagne actually it was on Christmas Day in 799, but it was almost 800, that Charlemagne kind of knighted the Pope, the King Charlemagne, you know, and Charlemagne was a little bit offended by it because from that point on, from 800 to the Middle Ages, the Roman system grew to such heights that even it controlled political, ecclesiastical, all affairs by the mid centuries, 1500s, 1600s, it controlled everything. And this is what the Holy Roman Empire is what we're talking about. We will see this, set up again, because when the Russian Gog is cut off from the East, we know then that the Pope will assume and take his place as not only the ecclesiastical head, but also the head of the political affairs and everything else. So this is what we're looking to see. This is what this image is all about. Time's getting away from me. I'm going to have to do some. One thing I'd like to maybe quickly note that there must be a power in the last days then that will arise that will take, you know, this, take control of this eastern leg, so to speak. And this power is represented by clay. I want to read to you from Habakkuk chapter 2, verses 5 and 6. It says this: "Hear also what the prophet saith of the Assyrian," and this is not what he said, but I'm going to get to it, "of the Assyrian who is forming, and who in forming the feet," and this is Habakkuk 2, verse 5, "lateth himself with thick clay, because he transgresseth by wine, a proud man, neither keepeth at home, who enlargeth his desire as the grave and as death, and cannot be satisfied, but gathereth unto him all people. Shall not all these take up a parable and a taunting proverb against him, and say, Woe to him that increaseth what is not his. How long? And to him that ladeth himself with thick clay." So therefore we see then that Brother Thomas saw this clay power. See, clay does not necessarily mean it's weak. It just means that it's much lower in value. It's fleshly. It's earthly. And nothing more earthly or fleshly than this Russian system. If you ever looked at the history of Russia, you will see what I mean. It is really a brutal history of Russia's 20 million people being killed by Stalin. I mean, you know, they've lost millions and millions and millions of people there because of evil people. Now, one thing I wanted to note, too, about Russia: how does Russia relate to the iron influence of the feet and toes and brass as well? How does Russia relate to that? Does she have any influence there? For one thing, they must possess the Catholic faith, the civilization, and sympathy if she is to be related. If this clay is to be related to anything that we've been talking about, the brass and the iron. Well, geography and economy made contacts between Russians and Byzantines inevitable. When I say Byzantines, I mean those that were situated in Constantinople. It made contacts between Russians and Byzantines inevitable since the very inception of Russia as a state and a nation. The adoption of Byzantine Christianity was, in fact, a free choice of the Russians. This is from Jan Meyendorf in his book, Byzantium and the Rise of Russia. Byzantium is nothing more than the brass image, so the brass of the image, the Grecian part of this image. Now, also, G. Ostrogorsky writes that since the adoption of Christianity as a state religion of the Kievan Principality, meaning Russia, in 988, the influence of Byzantine civilization, or Eastern Roman, as well, upon Russia became the determining factor of Russian civilization. The very extent and character of that influence should be understood in the light of three main elements whose combination determined the life of Byzantine society: the Roman political tradition, the Greek literary heritage, and the Orthodox Christian faith. They possess all of these things. Is it any wonder that Russia then would be the power that would allow this image to stand? It's got the most military set up. It's the largest country in the world. It's got vast resources. It controls much and is very evil-minded in many instances. Russia owes her religion and the greater part of its medieval culture to the Eastern Roman Empire, both directly through her connections with Constantinople in the 9th and 10th centuries and indirectly through the Slavo-Byzantine schools of the 10th century Bulgaria. Byzantium brought to Russia five gifts: her religion, her law, her view of the world, her art, and writing. This is from Dmitry Oblensky, Russia's Byzantine Heritage. Enough on that. Now, I'm going to have to skip quite a bit here, but I'm going to kind of try to close this down here. Now, Russia, we know Ezekiel 38:4 states, "I will turn thee back and put hooks into thy jaws, and I will bring thee forth and all thine army." We know that we talked about this earlier in past. And Ezekiel 38:16, and thou shalt come up against my people of Israel as a cloud to cover the land, and it shall be in the latter days, and I will bring thee against my land. Well, we know Turkey then is probably the first choice of Russia, as we noted from this map. We note that Turkey right here, is Russia's first choice, because after all, the Byzantine religion was developed there. The Eastern Orthodox Catholic faith was developed there. The Greco-Roman influences there. Russia called it heaven on earth when they had the great St. Sophia Cathedral there where they worshiped. They all had to flee when the Ottoman Turks took it in 1453. And most of the ministers and priests and whatever you want to call them fled over to Moscow. And Moscow became known as the Third Rome at that time. This is very, very critical. Russia looks upon this area here as a source of a warm water entrance into the Mediterranean Sea. They have access through there to the major oil states. They can get down to control of the Suez Canal through their military expertise. They have holy sites in the nation of Israel that they want to protect. Then the mineral deposits in the Dead Sea are another vital source of things needed. They say that the mineral deposits there are really tremendous. You ought to look at that sometime if you can ever find some information on that. Russia and Iran have joined forces to create long-range nuclear missiles. Former Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, when he was ruling under the Israeli intelligence office, gave photographic proof that Russian scientists were directing and supervising Iran's nuclear weapons program. They have, in effect, 8 sites where they're developing these things. According to Asia Times Online, a reporter noted that Russia's relations with Iran have advanced considerably in the last 18 months, and this was written in 2005. In addition to increased investment in Iran by Russia and burgeoning arms trade between the two countries, Russia is heavily involved in Iran's newly developed nuclear energy industry. After much wrangling and repeated U.S. intervention, Russia and Iran finally signed an agreement in February of 2005, a deal clearing the way for the shipment of Russian nuclear fuel to Iran's nuclear power plant at Bushehr. And Bushehr, I don't have it on this map, but it's just right on the Persian Gulf, Bushehr is. On August the 10th, 2005, the BBC News called Russia Iran's main partner in its effort to develop nuclear power. A former PLO terrorist and suicide bomber stated, "The UN clearly says they will not disarm Hezbollah, so they will be rearmed by Iran through Persia, through Syria. They will have more powerful missiles. It won't be Katyusha rockets next time. It will be laser-guided missiles that will be accurate enough to hit the Israeli Knesset, or the Congress of Israel. Hezbollah is collaborating with Iran and are under their control, and Iran will take over Iraq," according to this Palestinian, former Palestinian terrorist who converted to Christianity. You know, the president of Iran is a very evil individual, Ahmadinejad. He called Israel a rotten, dry tree that will be annihilated by one storm. This is from MSNBC News Services, April 14, 2006. His response to the nations of the world who are concerned that they are making nuclear weapons to attack Israel and America is as follows. "Our answer to those who are angry about Iran achieving the full nuclear cycle is one phrase. We say, be angry and die of this anger." BBC News, April 13, 2006. His tirade against Israel has made it clear that he intends to use nuclear weapons against the Jewish state. "There is no doubt that the new wave of attacks in Palestine will soon wipe off this disgraceful blot," meaning Israel, "from the face of the Islamic world. Israel must be wiped off the map." This is from Al Jazeera, the television station of the Muslims, and they also have a website as well, I think. Ahmadinejad has also denied that the Holocaust ever happened and that 6 million Jews were ever slaughtered in Hitler's final solution. And we know this, they had a meeting not that long ago in Iran, in Tehran. And a bunch of nuts from all over the world went there to say that the Israelis, that the genocide of the Israelis never took place. They had even one nut from the U.S. over there stating that. You know, they ought to put that person away somewhere. It made me angry when he was saying that. Another thing, quickly, I will say about the U.N., is Israel has been declared a terrorist state by the U.N., and they're still, in effect, 30% of the UN's directives and warnings are concerned with Israel. Can you believe that? A nation that Arkansas is at least 7 to 9 times bigger than, they got Israel, gets 30% of their warnings. I mean, it's unbelievable. Do we not see the Almighty's hand at work here? He's working the nations up into a fever pitch, because we know in Zechariah 14:12, "Behold, the day of the Lord cometh, and thy spoil shall be divided in the midst of thee, for I will gather all nations against Jerusalem to battle." One of the greatest signs of all is what we're seeing now with Israel. All nations, when we say all nations, we're speaking primarily of those in that great image empire. And what I want to do is show this empire, and I'm going to have to close this down. We'll never get to it. I want to show this, and I know this map won't show either. I want to show this. That's a shame, but I can't have a better map than that. I tried to get it. I tried to have it run again to get it a little bit lighter, but it's kind of hard to do. Israel is way down. Is a little lot, and Jerusalem's about down here. Right up here is Moscow in that map. And it's, when you talk about the king of the north, who would you say the king of the north is? Is it not the Russian god? It's directly north of Jerusalem. Moscow is. I didn't even probably draw it as close as it really is to the north. But this, Brother Thomas noted this about he says, "By turning to a map of Europe and Asia, the reader may trace out the territory of the kingdom of Babylon as it is destined to exist in its last form under the king of the north in his Gogian manifestation. The names of countries furnished by Ezekiel will lead him to a just conception of its general content. Besides of all the Russias, it will take in Norway, Sweden, Denmark, Holland, Belgium, France, Spain, Portugal, Italy, Switzerland, Germany, Prussia, Prussia now is really all under Germany, Austria, Turkey, Persia, Tartary, which probably was mostly in Eastern Europe, Greece, the Roman Africa, and Egypt. This will be a dominion of great magnitude, extending from the North Sea to the wall of China and Afghanistan, and from the Ice Sea to the deserts of Africa and Arabia." If I was to draw this here, I'm going to draw it like this. Draw it like this. I'm going to draw it like this. And probably take in part of Ethiopia down here. Some of this may be a little bit missed here. It'll take in Pakistan, Afghanistan. It'll come around. And the parts that will be somewhat flexible here, you know, it'll come here. And it'll come here. And it'll come and take all of this as well. So, I don't think I drew that too well, but see, part of this, like Saudi Arabia and Jordan and some of those, will be somewhat left out of this, because they will escape out of God's hand. Edom and Moab and such. So, but anyway, if you see that whole probably didn't draw that too well. It should have come around probably more like this. And we would erase that in there. So, but anyway, that's a tremendous territory, is it not? That's what Nebuchadnezzar's image, what the map will look like. And I think I'm probably going to have to quit, or we will never get through with everything. So, the only thing I hate about maps is that it takes a long time to get through all of it. I'd have been through a long time ago if I didn't have all these maps. But that's neither here nor there. I wanted to show these things, and I hope you can see them fairly well. I'm going to have to pardon me a minute. I've got everything messed up here to a great extent. Trying to find my... Yeah, there it is. I guess we could have our memorial hand.